listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I'm your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-TM.
Oh, that's right. It's Miguel.
I got it this time. He's a TM this time, and he's a tank master because he's been running a weird-ass, basically a pool game called Prawn.
It's like a pool LARP.
Yeah, I'm apparently going to make a character for my pool game today. It is episode 152, covering In the Danger Room, Prawn, McGill's Got Stuff. I am, of course, I'm actually going to be wrapping up, I believe, Operation Winter, which is my take on, for my campaign, Coyote's Aegis, my version of Writhing in the Dark, which is a beloved module we've been talking about for quite some time now. We've talked about a bunch. And the thing is, I was just saying before we started that, like, I don't know that I have that much actual content for this episode, because I feel like a lot of the transcript for this session is just back and forth, you know, people hitting each other and doing damage and stuff. And, like, apart from the basic thing of, like, yeah, and then they trade blows, and then so-and-so goes down, or you know, they slay their opponent or what have you, apart from those key moments, I don't think there's too much going on. I don't think there's too much to really get into. So
we've talked about this on the show before, how combat, especially in D&D, feels like sort of a central component of the game is D&D combat, but it's also the least interesting part to describe for the reason you just said.
Well, except that I've had...
When you play it, it's fun because there's the thrill of the dice roll and are you going to get a good hit at the right time? But actually talking it out can be a bit dry.
Except that the last few episodes I've been talking about, like, I've talked about a few combats now, and, like, those were fairly exciting. They were had a lot going on. A lot of wacky stuff happened in them. We had face huggers and prisoners and teleporting and people going down and whatnot. There's just, I don't feel like there was as much of that going on in this session.
Hmm. Well, I know what's coming, right? This is the big climax, the boss level of, or the boss encounter of Writhing in the Dark,
yeah, this
I assume.
Is the big finale. Do you want me to just get into it then?
Sure, yeah, you might as well.
So they're in the heart of the vault, a large diamond-shaped chamber decorated with stone carvings of skulls and brains of various sizes. The crevices in the walls and ceiling pulse with an alien glow that provides shimmering dim light throughout the chamber. In the center sits a glittering heap of gold pieces. Jend has moved in, while disguised in shadow, to approach the gold and subsequently detected an invisible presence nearby. Then a Gith warrior entered the room from an entrance to the south. Connor and Hex are at the west entry point. And Connor has a grenade at the ready, but the Gith does not appear to have detected anything within the room yet. Whatever the case, the Gith appears to be ready for a fight. He has a katana in his hands and is clad in the same silver half-plate that they saw the other warriors wearing. And,
I like how the central chamber has... It's festooned with carvings of brains, right?
Yeah!
I like the idea that this Illithid's lounge, he's decorated it with, like, his favorite food. I imagine the Tom Lando equivalent would be, like, a room full of carvings of cereal boxes.
A room that's just festooned with rubber chickens. Look at this mockery of food.
Novelty cereals,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, man, joke cereal.
Novelty candy.
Joke food. I'd have it. I mean, I don't know. I feel like the way to go with that is just make little fortifications out of cereal boxes. But
I thought you were about to say you're realizing now that you're actually kind of living like that already as you look around at all of your cereal boxes and joke candy stashes.
I wish. I don't have none of that going on right now. I'll tell you, around this room, I see two cans of chicken noodle soup. I see an empty box.
What?
For,
really?
Nature Valley. It's flipped to the French side right now. The box knocked over, so it's sweet and salty. It's nut bars. The point is, I got nut bars. Or it's a, it,
nut bars and chicken noodle soup.
I got nut bars in my bag. That's an empty box of nut bar. But yeah, this has been a tangent about what food Tom has in his room.
Do you have a means of heating the chicken noodle soup in your room?
I'll take it downstairs when I want it. I did that. I'm pretty sure I did that just today with a can of chicken noodle soup. As I grabbed with the can, and I took it downstairs, and I made the chicken noodle soup. So, Gent, before they can react, says it's something moving rapidly through the air nearby. Large, likely moving of its own power or some sort of psionics. They can't see it, but it's there. It moves away from them to the southeast. And that is... They're detecting it with their blind sense. And as it moves away, it suddenly comes out of invisibility, hovering over to be right behind the Gith. It's an Illithid. Though it radiates a malign darkness and appears to have two more tentacles than a normal Illithid, suggesting it is some kind of mutant. It has six face tentacles rather than four. Gent is like, yikes. And Gent decides to wait and see what happens next, but readies their gun to shoot at the first sign of aggression. Before the Gith can react, the Illithid has appeared behind it, lets out a dread wave of psychic energy which continues far beyond the Gith to hit all of the party as well. And apparently, it was aware of all their positions. So it does its psychic wave. The Gith slumps its shoulders, immediately falling out of its ready combat stance. Connor and Hex both take 39 points of psychic damage and are stunned.
Oof.
Gent manages to get by okay. They were not surprised, and they managed to get another turn. So it basically just becomes Gent versus the Mind Flayer for a little bit. So they take out their gun and shoot the Illithid, and, creature focuses its foul glare on Gent, and there's also this like moment of Gent being like, does the Gith count as an ally for sneak attack? And it's like, well, you don't really know yet because it's stunned, it's incapacitated, so it can't grant sneak. But if it's not, if it wasn't stunned, then you could get a sense of like, if it was an enemy or not, right?
Does it count as an ally just because it has the same enemy as the party?
I mean, I think that technically it does for the purpose of sneak attack.
Okay.
But in this case, it didn't matter because the Gith was, like,
right,
mind wiped. Gent moves up to the... Gent moves up to the Illithid and draws their crucifix sword, their crucifix rapier, and sets it ablaze. And then they swing at the Illithid and bringing him to 69 HP, to which everyone was like, nice. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they disengage. Alex is like, man, hopefully this Illithid is hungry and takes some time with the Gith. And Hex manages to save versus stunned. The Illithid seems to draw power up from the glowing crevices of the cavernous vault, its eyes flaring with baleful energy. Its tentacles fly up as it releases another wave of psychic energy. Connor and Hex must make saving throws. Hex begins gibbering uncontrollably, though this does little to hinder him beyond limit his capacity for speech. If anything, it's bringing him closer to his raging state. Connor and Hex are forced to make intelligence saving throws. Hex is stunned again, and both of them take 48 psychic damage. The jet is just like, holy crap. The Gith shakes itself awake, turning to address the threat behind it as it raises its katanas. The glowing crevices throughout the room hum and flare loudly. Suddenly, a giant spectral six-fingered hands surround the Illithid like a protective cage. And then Connor remains stunned, goes back to Gent's turn. Big ghost hands are protecting the Illithid, but the Gith Def looks like the enemy of their enemy, which allows for sneak. And so Gent runs back in with the sword. Their sword flies through the ghostly hands as if they weren't there, and the Gith is struck in the back with a blazing blade. The Illithid is struck in the back with a blazing blade while he is turned to fight the Gith. The Illithid chokes up thick purple blood as Gent falls back. The Gith looks pretty happy at the state of the Illithid and tightens its grip on its katana. Hex is back in action. He saves versus stun. Then the Gith lays into the Illithid with its sword. The first blow is deflected by the spectral hands, but the next is twice as forceful and cuts directly through into the Illithid, and the Illithid is cleaved in half. The hands turn into wisps of glowing mist that quickly disperse, and the light glowing from the crevices in the room fades somewhat, providing only a dim glow. As this occurs, Gent sees three more Gith like this one come charging into the room behind it. Seeing the Illithid slain, they form up next to their kin, and facing this group, the party, the gathered Gith grin wickedly and raise their blades. And Gent is like, fuckers. And Hex tries to say, great, these goobers are back and they stole our kill. But he's still got the gibbering effect on him, so actually he just goes, blah, 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 blah. And Connor just kind of moans because he's too stunned. The Gith that just killed the Illithid begins to head for Hex, but then flashes out of thin air and appears in front of Connor instead. The rest of the Gith also use similar teleportation to get up close, two getting on either side of Hex and one getting up to Gent. One of them slashes into Gent. See, this is where things start to get just like, they're just trading blows with the Gith. Gent.
Well, something I can say about this encounter is I really like mind flayers as sort of boss monsters, and I find that usually I'm inclined to use them as like the big bad evil guy, right? Like the final boss or the Phantom Menace.
Yeah, they got that evil mastermind vibe to them.
Exactly.
I wrote a module
what
where
I like about
writing... Illithid is the final boss.
But I like something I really, yet another thing I like about Writhing in the Dark is the ability to build up the tension, you know, like laying down these hints, their brains everywhere, people missing their brains, all of it leading to the central chamber. So like building up the tension to find out what it is and then revealing that it's an Illithid, but not having to make it like this is the end of a giant plot arc or anything.
Yeah, it's
like a rare opportunity for a one-off Illithid.
Yeah, it's a great little detour scenario that happens to feature an Illithid. Another thing here is that the Illithid ends up in this case being less of like, it is a serious threat. Like it does some serious damage with those psychic waves, but it ends up getting killed by the Gith before, who end up being the real threat because the Gith are the ones who have teleported in to get their silver blade back from Hex.
Right.
And so, you know, we knew that this wasn't going to end without them facing the Gith one more time. And so this showdown had to happen. The Gith just start laying into everybody, basically. Gent tries to strike back, but unfortunately their blade is deflected by the fine silver plate worn by the aliens. The hex opens fire, and the Gith start getting hammered by lasers. I remark that it's a very sci-fi moment. One tries to attack Gent, and the first attack falls short of Gent's escape, but the next just barely bypasses the protection of the Ioun Stone of Protection hovering around their head. The Gith that slew the Illithid flails uselessly with his katana against Connor's heavy armor. Hex manages to dodge one blade stroke before another crit falls on him. The next Gith also misses its first strike before managing to get one in, though this hit is less lethal. Then the Gith all teleport away from Hex. After reappearing throughout the room, they split up, two of them moving into adjacent chambers. Connor remains stunned. Gent is like, oh shit, are they going to try and lock us in? Gent, seeing that the Gith have split off into different rooms, they rush over to Connor, who is in his like stunned state, but he mentioned at the very start of the fight that he had a grenade ready. And so Gent basically says, I'm going to take that grenade out of his hand that's been in his hands this whole time, and I'm going to throw it into the room, into one of the rooms that they went into. So they toss a grenade after those Gith.
There's also this whole, basically the whole scene I'm doing in the background, this thing of, like, because, Connor and, or at least Hex, because he's not stunned anymore, is going to be using healing potions here. But I need to make sure if he drinks the poison healing potion from the, Illithid's cooler, that gets marked, basically. Hex takes a shot and plugs the Gith kill stealer with a final round, knocking him dead. The remaining three Gith all move in to surround Hex, using teleportation to close in on him. Hex manages to dodge three strikes before one finally hits him. And finally, the last Gith thrusts into his back as he is attempting to dodge his surrounding attackers and deals a critical hit. And Hex is brought down as he falls. The one that dealt the last blow strides 5 feet toward Connor, who is still stunned. And he tries to save, but he doesn't get it, even though Gent is like, please, for the love of Paylor. So it's all down to Gent now. Gent just goes ham, skewers a Gith in the leg, and they think that they've hit something critical based on the excessive bleeding that results. The Gith appears to be fading fast. Hex, Gent uses their bonus action to feed Hex a healing potion. Hex stands up, drinks a greater healing potion. Bad news, there were three greater healing potions that they picked up on the icebox. Two of them were actually potions of poison made to look like greater heals. Gent got the lucky one. Hex drinks the poison one, and I'm pretty sure Connor doesn't drink his poison one for a long, long time. It, like, gets lost in his inventory for ages. But also, great thing about this, so Hex is, like, just gone down. He gets up, drinks a healing potion. Oh, no, it's poison. P of P against P, McGill. Hex is immune to poison from the Puriap to proof against poison. Nothing happens.
Okay, wait, though. So nothing happens, but does that mean that he also doesn't notice that it's poison?
I mean, he notices that it doesn't heal him. Doesn't work. Well, I think the thing is that, like, Hex also has a pretty refined palate. I feel like he knows when he's drank poison. I think if anybody's going to know, it's going to be the lizard man who bites everything and has immunity to poison.
But isn't the poison disguised as a healing potion?
Yeah, but it doesn't work as a healing potion.
Right, but
so it just does really what nothing I'm trying but to taste like poison.
Well, what I'm saying is it might not even taste like poison if it's disguised.
I think it's only visually disguised as a healing potion. That's the way I read it anyway.
Fair, fair. Really, I'm just thinking of a scenario where he drinks it and just doesn't even realize that it's poison, and therefore no one has any reason to suspect that any of the other ones are poison either. But I guess they didn't suspect them anyway.
So Hex draws his guns and just starts blasting people. I also have a little note. P.S. Don't steal healing potions from Mind Flayer ice boxes. Say it's
probably haunted.
It's so classic that an Illithid would be the one to keep three drinks in his fridge, two of which are poison, just in case of thieves. The Hex said, I mean, come on, everybody else leaves random healing potions around all the time. It was Connor kept failing his saving throw against the stun effect that like hit him very, very early on. And it was this, like, it kept at some point it became a point of discussion, is like, man, is there anything that we can do to like get Connor back in this fight? And I was like, I mean, I'm starting to wonder when he's going to naturally shake it off. It's only lasts for 1 minute. And they're like, no, it's only been like half the time. And I'm like, yeah, he also got hit twice. So it reset after the first one. And Alex is like, if only someone could read the Scroll of Greater Restoration he has in his bag. And Chantel included a picture of, is it DW from Arthur? Girl, she's looking at a sign on Arthur's room, and it just doesn't say anything on it in this image, and the caption says, that sign won't stop me because I can't read. Gent shoves another superior healing potion down Hex's throat, like splashing water on the boxer's face. Come on, Rock. Then Gent skewers the final Gith, or no, not the last Gith. Gent skewers a Gith and burns him to death. There were a lot of crits going off on the Gith around here, and Alex kept rolling these crits with his like Hex blasting with his Aphrodite revolver and his laser pistol. At some point, I just wrote, Gith better have my money after that Nat 20. And also then I included a little quote. But I have a soft spot for bitch better have my money because after all, I am the bitch. You know who said that?
No, who said
that? Mads Mikkelsen on why it is his favorite Rihanna song.
Hell yeah.
Guess that's how he sees himself in the music video.
Mads is just the best.
The Gith remains still standing after the crit and doesn't turn from Connor, remaining in place to try and strike the half-orc down, and it gets a nat 20. Alex is like, man, it didn't even need it. And Jet's like, oh, shit. And it deals 69 damage total.
Nice.
And, Hex is brought down after a second blow. So the Gith turns to face Jen and Hex as he stands over their fallen ally. He fails a saving throw, so they see Connor's blood pooling at the Gith's feet. Jen moves up, but holds their attacks until Hex is in melee combat with it. 2-1 clash, vengeance for Connor. Jen moves in, taking fighting stance, but holds. The Gith readies to defend, but then is distracted as Hex closes in. In that moment, Gent slips the Crucifix Rapier's blade under the Gith's right arm for a killing blow that cauterizes that is delivered right to the creature's critical internal organs. Hex uses his action to feed Connor a regular healing potion. Connor returns to consciousness and is no longer stunned. However, when he attempts to mutter a pain thanks, he discovers himself incapable of speech. I also noted that when Hex said the thing about kill stealing goobers, it actually came out blah 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 blah. Alex says, can Hex speak now? And I say, nope, Hex is still gibbering. And he says, blah, 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 blah. And Gent says, this seems like the best time that we decide that I get all the gold in here. Those who oppose say so now. And Alex says, blah, 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 blah. I agree. I do deserve it. I will search Connor's belongings and find the greater restoration scroll. Connor, do you think this is what will fix you? Fix what you guys have? Nod or shake your head. Connor shrugs. There's gold is distributed, and or not, you know. So Gent basically has to do a sort of like magical psychoanalysis of Hex and Connor in their current state, because they only have the one greater restoration scroll, and they're not really able to use it because they're not a spellcaster. I mentioned that while Gent can technically use any item, I don't believe a non-spellcaster can cast from scrolls. So I let them do an arcana check to just sort of like get a read on them, or like diagnose them. And they got a 26, and so I said, you believe these symptoms will fade with time, but is likely there will be lingering damage done to Hex and Connor's minds that will require a spell like Greater Restore to reverse. This is once again trying to shout out those madness rules that are so important to this campaign. Do you ever use that when you're running Writhing in the Dark? Like, I think it's a special thing that you get affected with a level of madness if you get hit by the psychic wave of the Illithid.
Yeah, but my players have never gone full crazy.
Yeah, but have they ever, like, have they been hit with the one level of it? Like, they get a level of madness every time, right?
Yeah.
So what kind of madnesses do you get? Have you gotten?
Gosh, I'm trying to remember because it's been a while. You know, I can't recall. I'd have to go back through my campaign journals.
Well, Connor was rendered speechless, and meanwhile, Hex was rendered gibbering. And I also mentioned, because there was a bit of confusion, is like, because of the way I enforced the rules of how spell scrolls worked in this case, I had to mention, like, the disguise scrolls from the time they were infiltrating the mantle previously, those were like an exception where they had like instructions for how they could be how they could be used. I said I did make a special exception for this with the specially scribed disguise scrolls that you found when infiltrating the mantle. That was because they basically had instructions for dinguses included. Gent said, disguise for dummies. So Jen says, okay, there anything else in this room that is interesting that isn't all the gold? I say, in addition to the gold, you see that the Illithid has dropped some sort of rod implement crowned with writhing spiked tentacles that resembles a living flail. And Jen says, oh, maybe this will reverse things for you guys, and goes for it. The thing writhes as though alive in Jen's hand and does not appear given to attack its willer.
I found my notes. My players only ever suffered short-term madness effects. When I ran this, with one group, that Gavin, who played Rath McGrath in Minds, Metal, and Wheels 2, he was playing in it, and he had the effect where he had to attack the nearest creature, which was one of his allies.
That one is absolutely brutal. Like, compared to the other ones, that one really messes things up.
And the other time I ran it, one of the players got frightened and ran away. just like ran out of the room, made it, basically spent their entire time running for the exit to the brain bucket until it wore off.
So Jen picks up this thing, this rod that with writhing spiked tentacles that resembles a living flail. And the thing writhes as though alive in their hands, but does not appear given to attack its wielder. And Jen says, I'm not going to wave it at my comrades. Jen isn't entirely dense, but if they hadn't passed out recently, then maybe. And I mentioned that tonight's XP payout is 7,800 XP. Jen, by the way, like, so this is my take on the Rod of the Pack Keeper that you can get in this module. That's something that you include usually. So my take on this was actually, I made it a Rod of the Pack Keeper, but since I knew none of the players were Warlocks, and so they wouldn't have really the use for a Rod of the Pack Keeper, instead I made it a crazy flail that basically the living tentacles will, like, attack the target and do extra damage. It's I made it a +2 vicious life-stealing flail.
Whoa.
Or, no, a +2 vicious flail, I think it was. I don't think I made it life-stealing. I can't quite remember. But, point is, real freaky. So Jen is like, I forget what else we were supposed to do here. Do you guys remember? Ah, shoot. And Hex or Connor don't know which, is like, well, we came here to stop the drones from getting brain eating. Also, Alistair had an interest in us checking this place out. And I mentioned Alistair specifically wanted you to kill the Illithid. He was a bit cagey about the details. And Gent says, okay, silent vote time. Who votes we stay and make sure everything is wrapped up? Who votes we leave now? And Hex pulls out the Helios C4 again. This is just a block of C4. And Gent is like, we blow this place up? And Hex goes, Blipplethorpe Glopple Glorle Glor. And Gent says, I mean, down. Do we have the means to demo this place? Hex waves the block of C4. Okay, fair. So let's get this set up and then get out of here. And Hex acts like he's being shaken. Hex sets the C4 to a timer and then gets to booking. They let Connor get ahead of them before starting the fuse, just in case he trips and shatters a femur. That was a decision that they made. And then also, I realized at that moment, the party still had brain caps from the MPOC, so they can eat those. They're not mad anymore. So Hex gobbles is up. As long as it's just one dose, they're okay. Connor follows suit. They only had one dose each. So they eat their brain caps, and then they're okay. I say there was some business given extras to people, but I think at this point, they've each got one. Connor can speak again, so he casts some spells. Hex and Connor are cured of their madness. Connor can speak, and so can Hex. And they can openly discuss blowing this place to hell. Connor casts Mass Heal. Everyone is at full HP. And then Hex is like, yeah, this is like a demolition charge. It should at least collapse enough of this place that no one will come back here. Why don't you do the honors, Gent? You're faster than us for getting out of this, for getting out of here. And Connor's like, I'm cool to blow this joint if you guys are. Gent lights it, and Alex is like, fuck, run! I say, more like sets it, but totally. And Gent says, maybe you should have waited, and then takes off. They successfully demo the accursed Illithid lair of the Aglock Vault, Den of Evil Cleansed. They now have 3 contacts they can potentially report in with. Alistair said he'll have something for them if they return to the Hellfire Pit they met him at. Rod the Dwarf hasn't heard from them since they left, and neither has Tusk. So, they decide to drop by Alistair first. And they return to the place they last were before the op. Smoldering pit of hellfire left over from the initial invasion of the Deathlands. As they approach, Alistair once again appears within the flames. Greetings! I trust your return means you've met with success. Jen says, mission was accomplished. And Hex says, sort of. Did you send another group after this guy? We had some competition. And Alistair strokes his blazing beard in thought for a moment and says, I suppose it is no surprise that such a vile creature would attack additional enemies. No, I did not send others. What was the nature of this competition? And Hex pulls out the sword that he found and says, some kind of aliens, I don't know, they dropped this. And Alistair's eyes light up upon seeing the blade. He says, fascinating, natural enemies of the Illithids then. You should keep that blade close. The Gith do not part with them lightly, and they hold great power. Did you take any other trophies? I trust your report, but I wonder if you have proof of the Illithid's demise. And Gent says, we blew up its lair, and he chuckles deeply. And Hex says, oh, didn't you grab his staff, Gent? And Alistair raises an eyebrow. And Gent says, do you need another brain cap? You still seem off from the madness. Obviously, keeping quiet the fact that they got the flail from the mind flayer. And Hex says, regardless, they're dead and the tunnel is collapsed. You have our words as MPOC agents. Alistair grins and scratches his chin. Very well. I suppose you deserve another trophy then for your efforts. And he tosses what looks like a necklace of large prayer beads to the group out of the pit, and Connor catches them, and he says, a favorite of mine. Each of these holds blazing fury within. Use them well and often. And he grins with a manic light in his eyes. And Connor gains a necklace of fireballs with 10 beads. Do you know this, nice. This item?
Yeah, you take off a bead and throw it and it becomes a fireball?
Hell yeah. Meanwhile, the greatsword, the silver greatsword, is a +2 vicious life-stealing silver greatsword of wounding, in keeping with the other vicious weapons, +2 vicious weapons that have been given people. And so then next, they can check in with Rod or Tusk. They can stop by the former on the way to see the latter. And on the way, Jank glares at Hex and says, dangerous items are safer with us than, say, someone in a pit who maybe we shouldn't entirely trust. When they arrive, Rod is busy ordering around a bunch of laborers carrying heavy burlap sacks of building materials when they reach the supply dump. All around, even upon their approach, they note the considerable progress that the Draelic forces are making in establishing outpost structures along the perimeter of the Forest of Agaloch. Connor considers that these outposts may later be the foundation for settlements in this area when the war is over. Rod seems just too distracted to notice their approach. So Gent clears their throat in an attempt to grab his attention. Rod turns briefly, then does a double take when seeing their group. Holy hells! I was wondering why I hear from you a lot again. How did your meeting with you-know-who go? He hurries over to a crate nearby. They say, pretty good. His business lined up with our own. Rod says, glad to hear it. Hey! Art and I were talking. We had this extra special gift we had lying around in the supplies, and, well, I figure nobody's doing more for our troops in the field than you guys. So here, this is on us. He lifts the crate and offers it to him, and Hex grabs it and tentatively lifts the lid, and resting on a soft pack bedding of hay with the crate. And within the crate are 5 bottles of Draconic whiskey.
Ooh. Party time.
Hex says, oh, quite the gift indeed. Thank you, sir. He says, don't mention it. Like I say, you guys are making all our lives easier, Rod says with a smile, giving Hex a pat on the arm as he returns to his work. Unless there was anything else with this scene to cover, we move on to Tusk. And they are reunited with their vehicles, the Jeep and the motorbike, allowing them to begin their journey back to Omega Base. Doesn't take long to reach the prison camp along their way. When they stop in, Tusk is overseeing a supply shipment delivery at the entrance. Tusk waves them over upon seeing them. Jenk goes over and says, Tusk says, any luck? Jenk says, absolutely. And he says, so what was happening with the brains? And Jenk says, used to gain access to a vault like a sacrifice. And Tusk says, damn, who is behind that? Nightside Eclipse? Gent says, the eternal war between Illithid and Gith. We have eliminated both issues. And Tusk says, ah, Illithid, so your guess was right. Figures. So case closed then? Hex says, yep, we killed them all and blew the tunnel. Tusk nods, then he grunts. Well, that'll just leave the paperwork.
And Hex says, I seem to be getting a message on my sending stone. Looks like Coyote wants us to move on at the double. And Tusk shrugs and going over the manifest of the deliveries signing for. Tusk taps it with his finger. Says, you want to save me some more? We got an unaccounted surplus here. Any of you want a free rebreather mask? And Hex is about to say, good luck with all that paperwork when... He says, I've already got one, when suddenly he says, wait. An extra could be useful, Gent mentions. And they're sort of discussing, like, maybe we can have it and then we can give it to a hostage or something. And we're trying to extract. Tusk shrugs and says, just save me some paperwork, all I'm saying. And so X grabs it and stuffs it into the bag of holding, and Tusk gives a smile and a nod and says, appreciate that. See you around. And I decided we'd pick up next time with their return to Omega Base.
Were this a movie or a TV series and not an RPG, that would be like Chekhov's rebreather mask that'll come in handy at a crucial moment when they needed a spare.
Oh, they'll probably find a use for it. Someone they deal with enough, like people that aren't them in their missions, you know?
Well, I'm not gonna hold my breath.
Yeah. Hey, but yeah, da-da. Like they ran into a captive in this mission that they could have given the rebreather to. They ended up giving their bronze griffin statue to him. So, anyways, that was one thing that one note that they ended on is Alex was like, man, I wonder if that MPOC scout actually made it back with the Gith hostage. I said it's an intense end to Operation Winter. And next time we begin Operation GoldenEye.
Oh, my favorite Bond film.
Really?
GoldenEye? Hell yeah.
Even more than Casino Royale.
Oh, way more than Casino Royale. You kidding really? Me? Really? Oh, yeah. So much better.
Well, that's my whole thing. My throat started to get real scratchy at the end there. I started to lose it a bit, but hopefully your masterful editing will see to that.
Not anymore. Now I'm going to make you look like a chump.
Just take out the parts where I coughed.
I got a bunch of stuff here, Tom. Stuff to share, stuff to talk about. And of course, we will also do a bit more playing around with Prawn, the swimming pool-based LARP, the live-action roll pool.
Hey, here you go.
If you will.
Live-action pool game.
But first, I wanted to share a couple of DM resources with you and our listeners. Both of these I found fun. We will eventually get around to linking them on our WordPress. First up, this one. I just found this on Imgur. It is the Dungeons & Dragons Character Creation Outline 5th Edition in 5 steps. You want something great for your DM screen? You want a quick way to get a character generated? Here's 5 steps, just a 5-step process. Super easy. I love this thing. Start, choose your race. This sheet lays out all the races with, like, all the specs, lifespan, when they hit adulthood, size, speed, common traits, sub-race traits. There's even a legend so that you understand how to, like, read this chart where it has all the silhouettes of the different races lined up, like a suspect lineup. Step 2 is choose your class, and again, just like divide it into columns with really simply laid out, they're just stats represented by stars in this case, but it tells you like your primary ability, your hit points, melee, range, defender, you know, just like all the sort of basics of your class. Then you choose a background and they tell you the 2 skill proficiencies that each background offers. Choose your alignment, even though there's no alignment restriction for race or class in the player's handbook. And then name your character, and that's it. Like, it's the most basic form of it. Like, you still got to do, like, equipment and stuff. But I just love this five-step, get it all together really quickly, lay it out on one sheet. They even have, at the top of this page, they have that little, I don't know what you call it, like the box that goes at the top of a character sheet where class and level, race, background alignment, player name, XP, and character name are all kind of laid out there. And they have the numbers there to show you the order in which you tackle these different facets of the character. I don't know. What do you think about this? I love this. It's efficient.
Oh, it's cool. Yeah, it's a neat little resource.
Sweet little resource.
I like the look of it. Do you have any favorites on this sheet? Do you have like a favorite race or a favorite class or a favorite background or like an alignment that you always lean towards?
I really, alignment, I'm usually chaotic good or chaotic neutral, personally.
I think that's generally true for me as well.
And I tend towards either halfling rogues or half-orc barbarians. It's just sort of where I end up, but I'm not against playing anything. You know what races on here I've never played, though? I've never played a tiefling, and I've never played a dragonborn. And the main reason for that is that by the time... When were they introduced? Like, Tiefling was 4th edition, wasn't it?
I think, including it among the
base classes, or base races?
Yeah, if it's base races, then yeah, Tiefling and Dragonborn came in 4th edition. But Tiefling were around in 3rd edition, whereas Dragonborn were like a new thing in 4th edition.
Yeah. The reason I've never played is either of those is that by the time 4th edition came out, I was like almost always DMing. So, you know, I wasn't making new characters with the new edition of the game. Yeah, I don't know. What do you tend towards? Do you have a character type that you tend to play? Goblin, right?
Let's play it's Goblin. Not on here. I have it's played not a on Dragonborn. There, but...
Right on.
Yeah, I feel like if I have a favorite here... Well, okay, my favorite class, bar none, is Warlock. And
Goblin Warlock is like your ideal character build.
Pretty much. I played a lot of Goblin Warlocks, for a time. It had been the only thing I'd played in 5th edition. I tend towards the same alignments that you do, I think, generally. For background though, I've played a lot of charlatans and criminals. I think that I lean toward criminal because criminal, as a sub background or like as a background option, has spy. And I find spy is a background that I often, default to.
For background, yeah, I usually do charlatan for my rogues. I'm a bit more freewheeling with my barbarians. Like, I believe Nox was an outlander, right? Yep. And, but I've done them as, like, hermits with the hermit background as well.
Yep.
And folk hero, now that I look at it.
So that's one thing.
That's one thing. Here is another resource. This one I can read out the URL. It is battlesim-zeta. .vercel.app. And this is just like an extremely handy little encounter engine. Feel free to put one together. First, you specify your player characters. And when you click add player character, it gives you just like the basics here where you can pick a base class and a level and use class specific options where applicable. But you can also pick a monster, or you can customize and input your own player characters, and the site can retain those for you from like visit to visit. So you can build the party that you are DMing for in here, and then use this to run in like test run encounters, if you will. Because that's what this does. So, like, let's add... I'm going to just do one with a 4th level barbarian. Then add an enemy. I'm going to add I'm just going to scroll down and stop, and it's going to be a Pit Fiend. They're going up against a challenge rating 3 Pit Fiend. Yeah, challenge rating 3 Pit Fiend. Okay. And this was not a good match. The Pit Fiend killed the Barbarian in one round. So let me try perhaps a lower level Pit Fiend. We're going to do a CR 1/4 Pit Fiend.
Yeah, I was about to say a Pit Fiend is a challenge rating 20.
But you can change the challenge rating in this with a slider.
Oh, and it'll change its stats?
I assume so. It seems like that stuff happens kind of like behind the scenes. But let's see here. Or I'll try here's a crocodile. It's going to go up against a crocodile. I need to clear my encounter. I've screwed this whole thing up. But the idea is that it basically runs like a sample combat. And gives you turn by turn, like, what will happen to the player character on average. It's just sort of like simulating each encounter. So, here.
I've already kind of done that with ChatGPT.
Oh, interesting. So in this case, my level 4 Barbarian is going to go up against 4 challenge rating 1/4 boars. And so round 1, everybody's got all their hit points. Round 2, the boars have done 7 damage. And the Barbarian used a reckless attack and one of the boars was killed. Round 3, another boar attacks and deals more damage. The Barbarian's down to 27 hit points of 38. The Barbarian kills a second boar. By round 4, there's only one boar left, and then the result after round 4 is that the Barbarian has dealt 79 damage, killed all 4 boars, and taken 16 damage from the boars. So I just think this is pretty cool. It's neat that you can do it in ChatGPT. I haven't tried that. But
yeah, ChatGPT
basically
won't
like,
give you like mathematics, but it can give you, if you give it profiles for characters, it can give you a genuine or a general guess at what a character will do each round.
And then, so once, you know, after you've done sort of a simulation of the encounter and you can see the breakdown round by round of approximately how much damage the party will deal and take, you can add more encounters. You can add new conditions as well, like the players are surprised. Or the players get a short rest. But if you don't add anything on, like if players don't get a short rest, the hit points carry over. So the next encounter starts, the Barbarian's down to 22 hit points. This time they're going up against a Cave Bear. On round 2, the Cave Bear actually deals a whopping amount of damage, 20 damage in one blow. But then, by round 3, while the Barbarian has dealt 37 of the Cave Bear's 42 HP, the Cave Bear manages to kill the Barbarian. So there's the short life of this random level 4 Barbarian that I've generated. Took out 4 boars, and then a Cave Bear came out of nowhere, and it was a fight to the death. Nearly bested the Cave Bear, but the Cave Bear took out the Barbarian. But I think this is really cool.
Barbarian wasn't part of Clan of the Cave Bear.
True enough. I just think this is really cool, and I'm definitely going to be using this to sort of balance encounters. I could see this being, you know, it's funny. Here's something we can relate it to that we've talked about on the podcast before. This is like, this is the D&D encounter equivalent of that website, howlongtobeat.com, right?
Man, I just keep thinking of Goblin Bet.
It is a bit like Goblin Bet. It's true. I guess you can kind of do your own, like, Goblin Bets. It's not unlike, it's a bit like Kobold Fight Club, too, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, I like the clean interface. I haven't tried it yet, but because it's a dot app, I imagine this probably works great on mobile as well. So just another really handy resource. if I was putting together like some sort of digital form of a DM screen, both of these things, the five-step character creation outline and the handy battle sim encounter simulator, these would be included. Now here's another thing. I guess I should have said, like, we're kind of in the tavern of corners here, because I'm not really talking about resources. I'm not talking about a new RPG yet. We're not in the danger room with Prawn. The last thing I want to talk about isn't actually an RPG. You could kind of play it like an RPG if you want, but I found out about this card game through the website Boing Boing. And this just sounds so cool to me. I love this. I'm going to send you the link so you can take a look at it too. The game is called Dust Runner, and it is a solo card game. It's one player card game. The game takes about 30 minutes to play. And the idea is that you, using the various like decks and cards that come in this sweet little tin, you create a Mad Max style vehicle. You can see on this webpage, they have you make it out of three cards, and the different cards can add different abilities and components like ammo, damage, fuel, and health, depending on how you customize your Mad Max rig. And then, another, like a chain of cards that is dealt out randomly generates the path that you take. It's almost the map to this reminds me of the video game FTL, Faster Than Light. Like, it's just these sort of like branching paths that come together at different bottlenecks. Some of the squares have a star indicating something special happening. And the encounters are just from an encounter deck. And the idea is you draw two cards face down. You flip over one, and you can decide if you want to have that encounter, or you can take your chance on the second encounter, but then you're like committed. You have the choice to sort of pass up the first one and go after the second one, but you risk it being a harder encounter. And then it's just like a race to the finish. You race your way down the map, trying to get to the end before the bad guys catch you, before the raiders take you out. And it's just it's a win or lose game. It's not even really like a scorer setting game. It's just a race to the finish. I love this. Compact. It's got a great presentation. I like the CGA graphics colors.
I really like modular, like the cards that you build your car out of.
Yeah, it looks really great. I love the build the car. I love that everything is based around cards, even if it's not all the same deck. Like, there's the deck for the encounters, and then there's the deck to build your car, and then there's a deck that's the map as well. Looks great. It comes with some dice, some tokens. It comes with a couple of little Mad Max vehicle figurines. This thing's $20. You can find it at thegamecrafter.com/games/dustrunner. And I'm totally picking this up. I think this looks great. So now we can go over to the danger room. And here we are. Back in the pool. Everybody back in the pool. As we discussed last time, like I gave the vast overview of Prawn. There's very little else to cover with it, but cover it we shall. But just to recap, as we established, Prawn is a LARP that you play in a pool with a whole bunch of friends. Definitely intended to just be like played at a summer party with a bunch of friendly nerds, and depending on what you feel like doing at the party, there's a role for you. If you feel like being in the pool, you can play this game, you can take on a role, you can adopt a character from a variety of different factions within the pool, like the Sharks, the Jets, the Friends of Katie Lou, the Squid, and There are timed events that the TM, the Tank Master, oversees. So the game starts, and then timed events occur throughout the game that introduce new elements and throw things into chaos. Any people who don't want to play in the pool can act like the hungry horde, the humans outside the aquarium at the fictional restaurant where the game takes place. The humans will occasionally approach the pool, and they will bring with them a bag, and then also you need two long makeshift hands, long, you know, like a pool noodle with a baseball glove on the end kind of thing, just long rods with hands on the end, and the fish in the pool never know.
I like how the example went from a pool skimmer to my crazy thing that I came up with last episode.
I mean, it can be just about anything. Yeah, what does it say here for the pair of hands? Slot handouts, horde. I know that they had a similarly silly suggestion for the hands. Pair of hands. We used 7-foot PVC tubing and then big pieces of styrofoam. The hands themselves were 3 feet long. So they're really big styrofoam paddles on the end of long pieces of tubing. And the idea is that the players in the pool, the fish, never know if the horde is coming to feed them, in which case they can get hit points, or potentially try to take them away and remove them from the pool to be eaten. And then, of course, there's a starfish that comes in near the end of the game, designating a random person as the chosen one that the Friends of Katie Lou cultists begin attempting to sacrifice.
Yeah, so, yeah, of course. So obvious, you know?
Obviously. And so one thing that I didn't cover is, you know, we talked about hit points. You need hit points because there are fights. There is combat. And the combat here is treated similarly to, like, how you do it in a LARP, in that the players are sort of expected to go through the motions themselves and bring in the TM as sort of like an arbiter, a referee, or a judge. And so the idea is, when you want to attack another fish, you point your fin at your target and say, "I'm attacking you." Then you and your opponent close your eyes or turn your backs, count to three, and then raise a hand in the air, holding up between 0 and 5 fingers, but never more fingers than you have hit points. Then you take the difference between the two hands. If the difference is 0, the defender takes no damage. If the difference is 1 or 2, the defender takes 1 damage. If the difference is 3 or more, the defender takes 2 damage. And then the defender gets an opportunity to attack the aggressor. So this combat can serve many purposes, but I mean, ultimately you're just trying to be the last fish standing. And some of those factions, like the Sharks and the Jets, have the additional mission of trying to identify other members of their own factions and shut down members of their opposing factions. The hit points, you want to have them on, like, as individual items, so like individual floaties that can be safety pinned or otherwise affixed to each player's bathing suit. So they got to be, like, waterproof, they got to be floaty. And the idea is you have, like, a cluster of items attached to you to represent your hit points. And then when you lose them, it's just a matter of taking them off and throwing them outside of the pool. And then once you are out of hit points, you can be you're incapacitated, where you just float on your back until you are either healed.
No way you should be safety pin and floaties, man.
No.
Just saying, that's a good way to pop a floaty.
Oh, well, true, unless it's made of, like, foam. The example given in the Prawn source book is cross-sections, like, cut up a pool noodle into, like, pucks cross-sections. and then attach safety pins to those. So that's sort of like one of the big mechanics is just how hit points in combat work. And the reason I bring this up is now we gotta make a character, Tom. And first up, we're gonna make your character, and you have a few things that you need to decide. First, you have to decide what kind of marine life you are. You have to be smaller than a large person, so you can't be like a whale. And you have to be seafood, because you're in a tank at a restaurant, so you can't be like a mermaid, probably not a dolphin. And you have to live in the water.
The other white meat?
You have to live in the water. It can be either freshwater or saltwater. And then the TM can also decide whether or not amphibians are allowed. One of the pre-generated characters is a frog, so it suggests that it can be allowed, but the source book says it's ultimately up to the TM. You gotta be a sea creature.
Yeah, but I have to be not bigger than a large person, right? Like,
that's right.
I don't know. Greenland shark jumped out to me, but it says it's likely one of the largest living species of shark, so I don't know about that.
You're a juvenile. How's that?
Yeah, sure.
Hatchling Greenland shark.
No, I'll be one of those goblin fish.
Yeah, there you go. Of course, you're a goblin fish
goblin
from the
shark.
Warlock
the
Sea.
Goblin shark.
Oh, with the weird the hinged
super
jaw.
I mean, it's the one that's called the goblin shark.
Yeah. Yeah, they have the jaw that's like the old Bugs Bunny mechanism with the boxing glove. You know what I'm talking about?
It
almost like telescopes and extends.
Yeah, it's got a super messed up mouth, man.
All right, so you're a juvenile goblin shark. You need some simple background or history for your character. It says here, characters should be simple and light. You don't really need any overly dark or brooding character concepts for a game about being in an aquarium and the game lasts 2 hours long.
Okay. So
just says like you have like a short history, I guess. How did you get to the tank?
I was chasing Brock Lovett, the guy from Titanic.
There we go. And you got caught in a fisherman's net. Before you knew it, you found yourself in a tank at a restaurant.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I was supposed to do there.
It's very vague. Like, this is literally what it says. The best way to start creating a character is to come up with a history for the character. Keep in mind that Prawn is a light-hearted two-hour game. Characters should be likewise simple and light. An overly dark, brooding character won't work in the game concept. When creating a character, start to think of what the character can do. There are several issues to keep in mind when defining a character. Where did it come from? What does it want to do here? How does it feel about the other fish? Etc. So, like, it's pretty vague. You got it. You're a goblin shark who you were chasing after the guy from Titanic.
I live in a shipwreck, and those instructors gave me a little bit more to work with. I live in a shipwreck, and my goal in the pool, well, I might be getting ahead of myself, because now I'm thinking about my faction.
Ah, okay. I mean, you can choose a faction anytime you want.
Friends of Katie Lou.
All right.
And I want to be the sacrifice.
Oh, you don't get to decide, though.
I know. It's just my hope.
I guess you can make a break for the starfish when you see that it's about to drop. So characters start with 7 hit points. Players can always have their characters start with fewer hit points, although they gain nothing for this. And then the final part of this is that you pick your fish shticks. So fish shticks are special abilities. Caitlin is laughing from the other side of the door. You laughing at me, honey? She's laughing at the fish sticks. So the fish sticks are special abilities that allow the player to bend the rules a little bit. Often they are only single use. Here are the fish sticks for you to choose from.
Oh, man.
So there are three different categories. Column A, column B, and column C. They are in, like, the power level increases with each column. So column A, they are low power fish sticks, and you have the option of choosing three. Or, so yeah, column A, low power, you have the option of choosing three, or you can choose one from column B and one from column A. Column B, of course, like mid-level power. You can choose two from column B, or you can choose one from column C and one from column A. Those are sort of the four optional packages that you can get. Three column A, one B, one A, two B, or one C, one A.
I am going to pick two column B. I'm going to take dodge and smart fish.
So dodge. When you defend in combat...
Oh,
if
no,
you hold
I don't want
one...
smart fish. I want secret stash.
Secret stash. All right. So dodge. When you defend in combat, if you hold up one finger different from your opponent, you take no damage. Secret stash. You have a secret stash of food. You can turn this shtick into a TM for two pieces of food, and you can only do this once. So shticks, similar to hit points, they suggest... like printing them out on acetate or something, making it so that they can also be affixed to the player or carried with them. And that's because some of these, as you can see, you can only do once, but also just any ongoing, like dodge, you probably want to have that on you so that you can show your opponent that you have that ability should the situation arise where you're only one finger difference. Here are some, I'll just read out a few sample column A's. A biggin. You start the game with two extra hit points. Fighting fish. You may always hold up five fingers in combat, no matter how many hit points you have. Remember, it's 0 to 5 fingers, but a max of your hit points. Fish food. Every time you eat an incapacitated fish, you gain a hit point. Sticky tongue. You're able to catch at least one food per feeding. If you did not get any food during a feeding, have the TM hand you a food after the frenzy had died down. You can only do this once. Here are a couple of column Bs. Clamp. You do 1 point of damage in a finger fling if the defender holds up the same number of fingers you do. So if you tie, you deal 1 point of damage. You can only do this for one combat, but it lasts the entire combat. Pinch. You may do an unstoppable attack that deals 1 point of damage before the combat starts. And you can do that in every combat. That's not a one-off only. It's pretty good. Shell. You take no damage from anyone this round in combat. I like that. You got a shell. They might, maybe they damage it. You can only use it once. And then a few from column C. Denied. You may keep another character from using one of his or her shticks. If the other shtick can only be done once, then that doesn't count as their use. You can only do this once. Shock. You may make a special unstoppable attack that does 5 hit points of damage. You do this instead of doing finger flings for your attack. You can only do this once. Slippery. You can slip out of the hands if you are grabbed, but you can only do this once. So those are just some samples. There are a bunch more on here. Different shticks that you can choose from, and the rules give you the rundown on how to create new shticks. But the honestly, creating new shticks, it says, it basically boils down to just like, work it out with your game master. Use the existent shticks as a guide. Try to judge the level of power of the new one. Shtick versus the ones that, or sorry, Try to judge the level of power of the new shtick versus the ones that already exist. In general, the power level of shticks is pretty low. Even if a fish had an overbalancing amount of powerful shticks, it could still be taken out by a few other fish working together. Keep that spirit or cooperation alive. Shticks should be kept simple. If you cannot explain the shtick in more than two sentences, you're trying too hard. So, I mean, it's pretty loosey-goosey with how to create your own shticks for your characters, but that's how they work. And if you want, you can give your guy a name. I think that's the final part of it.
Just my name?
Yeah.
Hook Punch.
Hook Punch, the goblin shark who lived in a fish wreck, but wound up in an aquarium. Wound up in an aquarium, and your abilities are dodge and secret stash, right?
Yeah.
Heck yeah.
I know how to keep a secret stash.
Now you are ready to play Prawn, if you so desired.
No, I don't.
No. No, you're just not into this one at all, huh?
I mean, I'm not much of a pool guy to begin with, so I'd want to be out quick.
So you'd probably sooner be a member of the Horde than actually playing the game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Tom, do you think we have time to cover another silly sort of improv RPG along the same lines? This one, the source book is 2 pages long.
Hit me with it.
All right. We're going to talk about Sea Dracula. And that's sea as in like the body of water. S-E-A. Sea Dracula. Before I even describe it, what do you think this game is about?
Vampirates.
Would you believe me if I said it's about animal lawyers?
Yeah, I would believe you.
Because that's what it is.
Wow.
This is basically, the setting is basically Zootopia. Animal City is a magical town full of hardworking, talking animals with crazy names and silly opinions. The city is famous for its nonsensical legal system, where the lawyers are responsible not just for prosecuting cases, but also for fighting monsters and throwing parties. This was the legendary legal system pioneered by a great giraffe lawyer whose name was Sea Dracula. The proud traditions of the Animal City legal system have been handed down from generation to generation, slowly losing their meaning and becoming strange and obscure. Don't mistake the ways of this legal system for those of your own. The lawyers of Animal City strive only to win. All other considerations, even the welfare of their clients and the sanctity of the law, are secondary. They dance the dance of the animal lawyers, and mere mortals such as us can only stand back and watch in awe and terror. So what is this? It's a role-playing game. Yeah, it is very random. Where you pretend to be animal lawyers prosecuting an important case in Animal City's highest court. You act out the 4 steps listed below, the 4 phases of the game, as though you are actors in a crazy, stupid cartoon courtroom. I guess another maybe touch point for this would be something like Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law.
Oh, yeah.
Use a funny voice if you want. As long as you follow the rules, you can do whatever you want. Remember that. Making up crazy stuff is part of the game. You need 3 to 6 players, paper and pencil to keep track of lawyer points, witnesses, and evidence, and then a space large enough for dancing. So, we're getting into Calvin Ball territory again.
The whole description of the legal system made me think that this was going to be another one of these gnomic things.
Surprisingly, it is not. I don't think you can really count it as gnomic because it does have clearly defined rules, even though there's a lot of room to be hashtag random, as you said. So phase 1 is the crime scene. A crime has been committed. It's up to the brave lawyers of Animal City to investigate the crime scene. Player who owns the game gets to set the scene, describing the location of the crime scene and the nature of the crime itself. Murder, treason, and robberies are good crimes. Parking violations are pretty boring. Don't waste your time with that. I disagree. I say waste your time with that. If you're going to play a silly courtroom game, by all means, you should absolutely include things like parking violations.
I think you could do it. You could get real wild with it and do like traffic court.
Yeah, exactly. Small claims court. You could do C. Dracula, but make it more like Judge Judy. Like, why not? Once the scene is set, the cops arrive and begin their investigation. We need to know what the cops find. So each player is going to take a turn describing three pieces of evidence and three witnesses to the crime. Everybody write them down. Make sure to tell everyone who your witnesses are and what your evidence is, because, of course, you're going to court. So you gotta share your evidence and witnesses. In Animal City, everything is crazy and strange, so don't waste your time with normal evidence and witnesses. Get really weird. Here are some examples. The cops enter the crime scene with pistols drawn. They hear a sound from the bathroom and rush to do some investigating. Tearing open the shower curtain, they find Abacus Rex whimpering and trying to cover his tender bits. Abacus Rex is my witness. While searching the kitchen, the cops spot a half-eaten order of egg foo young from the Chinese place on 5th Street, and the victim hated egg foo young specifically, so the Chinese food is the evidence. Do you find any evidence?
Yeah, I found a stick of dynamite. Who was planning to use this? It was under a chair.
Oh, dangus, dynamite from under a chair.
It looks like it was lit, but the fuse went out. Here, let me fix that.
Very intriguing indeed. Make sure to put some spice into your descriptions, role play a bit. Once each character has had a chance to introduce all his evidence and witnesses, move on to the next step. So remember, it's three evidence, three witnesses per player. Step two, opening statements. Now it's time for the trial. The players take turns giving their opening statements, stating who they are.
What do you think Abacus Rex is?
Well, it's tough to say, you know, because, like, Abacus Rex...
He strikes me as an old goat.
I think old goat is pretty good. You're tempted to think it's like a dinosaur with Rex, but, you know, Rex, I also think maybe a dog. Maybe Abacus Rex is like a dog.
Yeah, or like an old goat.
Or like an old goat. We'll go with an old goat. So players in phase two, players take turns giving their opening statements stating who they are and who they represent. This is when you tell us the name of the animal lawyer you yourself are playing, and don't choose a normal name. You got to choose a crazy name. If your animal is like a horse or a beaver, don't call it like something horse or something beaver. Here are some examples of crazy names.
Oh, you know what this is like? It's like BoJack Horseman.
Yeah, except it says don't do the BoJack Horseman thing.
Yeah.
BoJack's good, but you got to pick something else.
I mean, the other names are good. Mr. Peanut Butter.
Mr. Peanut Butter,
What's the cop's name? Officer Meow Face or something?
Princess Caroline is pretty great.
Yeah, it's just the cop that always shows up is like Officer Meow Meow or something. He's got a great name.
Jason Morningstar. Weird Beard.
Oh, is this a Jason Morningstar joint?
Yard Ass. I like this. Yard Ass.
No, but...
Mystery G.
But was this created by Jason Morningstar?
No.
Really? Wow.
I don't think so.
That's shocking to me.
Nick and Jake. It's just by Nick and Jake.
Jason Morningstar, creator of Fiasco. Just giving him a shout out, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Jason Morningstar, they give him a shout out because he has a laudatory quote on here. See, Dracula is now my favorite game.
Wow.
I wonder if he even actually said that. I wonder if he even said that. Maybe they're just friends with him, and he was like, yeah, I don't know, put a blurb on there. The player who owns the game goes first. This is a running theme. Whoever owns this game gets the first turn in each phase. Players can represent the city, the defendant, or anything else they want. It's not uncommon for animal lawyers to represent other countries, abstract concepts, religions, or shapes. It doesn't matter who or what your animal lawyer represents. All that matters is that they have a theory about the crime that they wish to prove in court, or just a theory in general. It's not uncommon for a murder investigation in Animal City to be derailed by a lawyer that wants to prove that ham is delicious. Important things to say during your opening statement. You gotta tell the court who you are. You gotta tell the court who or what you represent. And then you gotta tell the court about the theory you wish to prove true that doesn't even have to relate to the crime. I don't know if you want to even do that.
My name's Yabba Dabba Nightmare, and I'm here to explain that you gotta get your chicken nuggets fresh. If you don't get them fresh, what's the point? I have evidence to support my claims and witnesses.
Are you a goblin shark in this one too?
No, I'm just an eel in this one.
Named Yabba Dabba Nightmare.
Yeah.
And your theory is that chicken nuggets are better fresh.
Yeah, you gotta have them fresh, or else what's the point?
See, this is perfect, because already I could see somebody throwing their hat into the ring on that one. Multiple animal lawyers could represent the same party. These lawyers don't work together. They argue different theories of the crime. In Animal City, it's not uncommon for 5 lawyers to represent the defendant, with no one representing the city. Guilt and innocence are relative. All that matters is that each lawyer wins. Go ahead and move on to the next step after everyone has given their opening statement. So, phase 3 is the courtroom scene. This is where the good stuff happens. Each player is going to take turns doing stuff, starting with the player that owns the game. You use your turn to do one of 4 different things. You can introduce evidence, you can call a witness, you can request a recess, or you can rest your case. And you keep taking turns until the court scene ends. So here are what those actions do. Introducing evidence. You choose one of the 3 pieces of evidence that you made up in phase 1. You stand up in front of everyone. You tell them how this evidence helps prove your theory. If no one objects, you get a lawyer point. If one of the other players objects, you gotta do a stupid dance. The objective player chooses the dance. If you can't do it or you don't want to, you don't get your lawyer point.
Put a dynamite under the seat, try to take out the guy who was going to tell the truth about chicken nuggets, but didn't work. And now what?
Man, I don't object to that. That sounds about right. It sounds like the victim was trying to prove the freshness of chicken nuggets is a major factor in their quality.
The nuggets is just made fresh. You got to prioritize. You can drop everything. Go get the nuggets.
Another action you can take. You can call a witness. Much like the evidence, you made up some witnesses during phase 1. Point to another player, it doesn't matter who, and say, "I call you," and you name the witness. And that player has to play the part of that witness for your turn. They got to read the Sea Dracula Oath. And then you get to ask the witness whatever questions you want. The witness can make up whatever answer they want, but they must answer your question. You continue until you feel you have proven your point, and then you say, "I've proven my point. I have no further questions." Other players can choose to cross-examine. The witness. That means that you both have to dance a dance chosen by the third player. The third player chooses the winner, who gets the lawyer point. If no other player chooses to cross-examine the witness, you get the lawyer point. You can request a recess. A player can request a recess for 3 reasons: to have a party, a boss fight, or a break. If no one objects, then you get to take a recess. If someone objects, then guess what? You do a stupid dance. The player who objects chooses the dance, and if you can't hack it, you just don't get your recess. Instead of dice, everything is based on whether or not you can do a requested dance, apparently. The reasons, as I said, for calling a recess, you are to have a party, a boss fight, or a break. So we'll just go through those. A party. Animal lawyers throw lavish parties that everyone enjoys. The player who requested the party gets to choose a dance. Everyone who dances, including that player, gets a lawyer point. If the player that requested the party buys everyone a drink, he doubles his total lawyer points. A boss fight. A boss monster attacks. The player who requested the boss fight must defend Animal City. Each player names a dance. You have to do them all to win the boss fight. If you can pull this off, every other player loses a lawyer point. Or a break. Sometimes you call the recess just because you need a break. You want to use the toilet or get a snack or make a phone call or maybe rush your friend to the hospital. The court scene cannot stop unless a player successfully requests a break, and the break lasts until all the players are ready to resume play. And then the last action you can take during the courtroom scene phase, phase three, is resting your case. On your turn, you can say, I rest my case. Your turn ends, each other player gets one more turn, and after that, the trial is over. So anybody can trigger the final turn of the game for everyone. And then finally, phase four, the jury. This is where you find out if you won the game. Add up all your lawyer points, and the player with the most points wins. If there's a tie, you have to do a dance-off, and a third player acts as a judge. If you want, you can play See Dracula with a jury. The jury consists of anyone who wants to watch but is too chicken to play. At the end of the game, the jury votes on the winner. If the jury votes unanimously for one player, that player wins. Otherwise, each jury vote for a player counts as a lawyer point, and the most lawyer points win. And that's the game. Pretty quick. And I think a good way to end it is with the See Dracula oath, which I mentioned before. Remember, when you call a witness, you point to a random player, and they're going to play the role of the witness that you wrote down in phase one, and they got to do the See Dracula oath first. Are you ready for it, Tom?
Hit me with it.
I, your name here.
I, Yabba Dabba Nightmare.
Solemnly swear. To stop, collaborate, and listen. And you can just keep on going until the line about waxing chumps like a candle, because the rest of the oath is just ice ice baby.
Okay. I don't want to.
That's fine. You don't have to.
Not me.
But that right there is See Dracula.
Not
that's it.
Me, baby. Not me, baby.
So there you have it. You know, we got some prawn, we got some See Dracula, just a couple of really silly little self-contained games, short form, meant to be played in short sessions, more like party games. This all goes back to the question I was posing last time, right? The difference between improv games and party games and role-playing games. Do you count See Dracula? Is that a role-playing game in your mind? You do create a character. You got to create some content for it.
It felt more like an improv game, though.
Yeah. Yeah. And Prawn, I mean, I guess Prawn is a LARP. Like, you create a character, you choose a faction, there's combat. I feel like that counts, right? There are hit points. It's probably a role-playing game, even if it's sort of like a party game-style role-playing game.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just... It puts
like, you get special
like the
abilities. There's just enough
to
yeah.
qualify.
But like you do pick a character, you do get HP, you do get special abilities, you do engage in combat. There are timed events. Like I feel like there's enough there that it, as you said, the bare minimum to qualify. But yeah, there we go. A couple of short form ones. I've been busy with work lately, so haven't had time to like dive into more complex stuff like Nobilis, but hopefully by next one I'll have enough time. I'll be able to do something a little more complex than animal lawyers and goblin sharks.
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a goblin shark. Yeah, I'll tell you one thing is next time I got Operation Goldeneye, and off the top of my head I can't even remember what it is. If I had to guess, I'd say that they're making a move on Lord Dio, having secured his schedule. Now's the time to strike. I don't know.
If you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or follow us, check us out on Facebook, Comparing Campaign on Facebook. If you want to see our show notes and supplemental materials, check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. This has been episode 152, recorded on the 1st of June, 2023. Who cares to play a bunch of games in a pool? Not me.
Level up, get that. Win your court case.
I'll do my best. Oh, no, jury duty. Ba ba da ba. Ba ba da ba.